kind of wanted to start in regards to, you mentioned your father earlier, and when you were here setting up, talk about a little bit his ideas about microtonality, because there's a lot of misunderstandings about what that means and doesn't mean. And you worked with him for many years and know about his teaching at NEC, New England Conservatory of Music, and things like this. So if you wouldn't mind talking a bit about his concepts and how he broke the scale up and all these kinds of things.
Well, it was kind of a, for him, it was a long, arduous process to get to the point where he got to. He started out playing kind of just pop music of the day, you know, clarinet, saxophone, and gin mills, he called them, and things like that.
And where was he playing? In New York City?
Yeah, New York, and touring around. And, you know, back then they didn't have jukeboxes, so, like, you actually could get a gig and kind of play five nights a week. And, you know, he quit school at 15 like I did and just started playing. He had learning disabilities, so he always said, you know, he played the wrong notes. He was kind of self, well, he had a great story how his three teachers were a shoemaker, a carpenter, or something like people, you know, like people from the Sicilian village kind of thing
okay.
that my grandparents knew. But he always played the wrong notes, but he liked the wrong notes. And then he couldn't figure out why. Mm. So he's playing the notes, and he's playing the wrong notes. And then he meets some guys that kind of like that in the late 40s, I think. And they start playing the wrong notes. And he got hooked up with Joseph Schmidt, who was a composer and a student of Alban Berg. And he studied the whole Schoenberg thing, where he got involved. You know, you got to learn, you know, Palestrina to the present, do the motets, do this, five parts, and learn every style. And the course was 3 years. It took him 10 years to do because of his learning disability.
Okay.
But after the 10 years, he had amassed so much writing and this, he really got it down. I think he understands, or he did understand music more than anybody I knew. A lot of people think of him as a kind of a free jazz saxophonist, kind of played funny notes. And then we'd be sitting in the car and he'd hear this kind of thing. Well, that's that Haydn thing, because, you know, this and that, and so-and-so, and this conductor. You know, like, he just had this really amazing understanding. Any case, so he liked the wrong notes. So then he got interested in, you know, playing weddings. And when you play weddings in New York back in the day, or still now, you start, you know, getting the Jewish gigs or the Greek gigs or this gig or the Irish gigs. Back then, you know, you had to know that stuff. So he really got into Greek music and Sephardic music and this and that on the clarinet, where they bended the note and this and that. So I think that kind of piqued his interest, because it wasn't just the wrong note. Now he could kind of control the note. And there's a really great recording that your father helped put out.
Oh, the duo with the drummer.
The duo with the drummer.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it was a peace concert from 1963 or 4 or something, where you can actually hear him, like, he's kind of, it's in 7 and then 9. But this is one section where, like, and I remember listening to this with my father, where he's just going, it's like, I'm like, what made you do that? He's, well, you know, it was a peace concert. I was thinking of suffering. But then those notes. And I think that was kind of that moment on that recording.
Okay, like an epiphany almost.
It was almost an epiphany. So then he got into it. And as a composer, he was writing 12-tone music mainly, off the Schoenberg kind of thing, that kind of thing. But he still wanted that. What is that? So he started fooling around with writing with microtonal music. In the beginning, just haphazardly, like writing slashes and this and that for, like, maybe quarter tones. It wasn't specific. But by the early 70s or mid-70s, I think he ran into a composer named Ezra Sims, who I believe passed away last year, who devised a system of an equal-tempered 72-note scale. So there's 5 notes between a half step. So it's all in twelfths. So there's a lot of notes. And but the way Ezra did it was, like, he divided it up. So those notes allow you to get close to any just intonation or this intonation or that. And you could make scales out of it and be close enough within a few cents. But my father decided to really just take it head on. And it's like, yeah, 72 notes. I'm going to use them all. all the time, you know, like, mm-hmm. So he got into using that for his compositions. And here's where it's tricky, because as an improviser, he's coming out of, you know, Lester Young and this and that and Billie Holiday, and as a composer, he's coming out of Schoenberg and this and that, and then he's playing Greek weddings and this and that. But, you know, he kind of, as an improviser, kind of mishmashed all of that. So, you know, like, for instance, when I was playing, you know, Nobody Knows the Trouble, you know. So, you know, this isn't like a thing in a monk in a cell thinking, like, 72 notes to the scale. But, you know, he's like... You know, he's not thinking, but it's to add a little tension. It's like that Billie Holiday kind of, you know, like everybody whose phrase is anything in jazz is a little this mm-hmm. or a little that. That's the voice. So he kind of got a reputation as an improviser who's microtonal. And as an improviser, I don't think he really thought methodically as much. But as a composer, he did.
Mm-hmm.
There's several pieces that employ the full microtonal spectrum. And he wrote a book called Virtual Pitch Studies in the Virtual Pitch Continuum. If you go to the Boston Microtonal Society website, I think you can get a copy there, where it really discusses those mm-hmm. and how he thinks of it in kind of an expansion of the Schoenberg theory book. Mm-hmm. He uses the same ideas just to expand on.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and you grew up in part playing with him. I mean, I know you played with him for years. When did you discuss the application of microtonality with you, or is it something you just sort of picked up by working with him and playing with him? Or
we did discuss it, and I'm so glad we did, because now it's just become part of my.
Mm-hmm.
Vernacular. Was a teacher at New England Conservatory of Music in the composition department. He taught harmony and performance technique in this. He was never in the jazz department or third stream, as it was called back then, or creative ensemble, or whatever it's called now. But as an improviser, he did like one concert a year at NEC. You know, he never played out. He wasn't in the club. You know, he had played a long time ago, you know, and he just didn't do it.
And what years were these when he wasn't really performing?
He wasn't
so much?
Performing. He started NEC in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
So from there on, he just, that was it. He didn't perform out, except for maybe a concert at the school once in a while, or he did perform at soirees. We had concerts at the house or somebody's house, and he felt the students at NEC didn't get a chance to work on their material enough in a performance situation.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, like, well, I got a neighbor. They have a living room. Let's go. Mm-hmm. And we make some pasta or whatever. And, you know, somebody would work out the Brahms Viola Sonata, or they work out this, or like some crazy thing. So that was always, I always heard music.
Mm-hmm.
He was always playing in the houses, but never professionally. Huh. Or professionally, I mean, but never out. So when I became a teenager, and I said, you know, I was just playing classical music till I was about 15, and then we had a falling out. But at the same time, I met with him, and he has started this group of people to work on microtonal music as a improvisational form. And it was a trombonist, keyboardist that had two keyboards that could tune different ways, and a drummer. And I just sat in with him one day, and boy, it sounded lousy. if you could imagine, like, six guys, like, you know, and back then it was just jazz, you know, but we're all kind of going like, like, so there's six of us going, no feel, no nothing, no groove. But I have to thank him for that, because it was a great year or two that we kind of just said, what is this? Mm-hmm. How can we make this work? Because he already could play, like, he just naturally had that thing. But he just made us kind of have to think of it in a certain way to catch up to him, in a way. And I hopefully I did. So
it was just through playing. It wasn't like he gave you sort of exercises to work on or things to train your ear. It was more like sit down, do it together.
Yeah, we did exercises together with this group. Mm-hmm. But he had started his class at NEC at that time and was writing the book. And I helped him design this keyboard that could play all the notes.
Oh, wow.
Because I was into computers back then. So we built a prototype, actually, which I still have, which is great. Wow. Looks like an accordion, but you can get all the notes. but, you know, it was weird because even then he knew, like, the improvisational thing was different from this kind of academic way of looking at it. But he felt like he had to really explore the academic side to kind of, like, be natural with the improvisational side. Because his improvisational side really came out of the blues and kind of spirituals and really, you know, African-American music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do you feel that, like, when I listen to your music and your father's music, you guys playing together and separately, do you feel that the microtonality aspect, the looseness of it when you put into the improvising, affects the phrasing, the rhythmic character of,
absolutely.
It's not just a pitch thing, it's a rhythmic thing too,
it
right?
is. Well, what we discovered was that when you change the melody like that, then you change the rhythm. You change the whole template of what you're going for. So we were working with the drummer Randy Peterson, and Joe's playing this kind of melody, you know, it's very speech-like. And Randy's like, how do I interpret, because he was coming out of bebop, you know, like, he's like, how do I interpret that? So then he's like, well, okay, it's like, you know, like, suddenly everything's just a glanced or, you know, right off the beat, and suddenly the time can get compressed. It's not rubato,
because
there's time, but it's like, and there's tension and release, but it's a different kind of tension and release. So yeah, I think the microtonal melody made the time micro. We called it snake time, actually. My father and I, snake time, because it's like, because you're doing these weird little intricate things that it just can't be like this. You know, it has to be, you know, that's how he phrased it.
Yeah, and those things are tied together. So,
and the same with the harmonies. Like, suddenly the harmonies become a little, you know, like, we have to lean your head to hear it right.
Yeah. Beautiful. In terms of your own music, and there's a lot of that, have you had any kind of influences from people that played your instrument, also improvisers, like, let's say, Leroy Jenkins or Mark Feldman or people like this? Anybody have impact on you? Or was it other kinds of music? Like, when you were downstairs before playing, I asked if there was any kind of music you'd like to hear, and pretty quickly you said, well, what about the Elliott Carter string quartets?
Yeah, that was a huge influence of the Elliott Carter string quartets that they were playing before I started, because, like, he was able to use these kind of not quite serial notes, but it was not quite harmonic, but make it sound very lush. But the time where he did these metric modulations, where it's like, to me, that swings. Like, so I'm influenced by things that I feel that swing, whether it's Elliot Carter or Sonny Rollins or this and that. As far as on my instrument, I hate to say this, but no, not too much. Mm-hmm. Although I can say a great little story about Leroy Jenkins. I was living in Boston, and there was a thing in the newspaper saying, we need a violinist who can improvise. I mean, you never see that. Yes. Like, the dream come true, like, circle it. But literally, it actually said that. So I went to audition, and it was this theater piece that Leroy Jenkins had written the music to, and it needed a violinist to kind of blow. So I, you know, I read some of the stuff and blew on some of it, and they're like, yeah, that's great. You're hired. And I'm like, great. And I was working at a cafe at the time. And I'm like, well, how much does it pay? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, you know, I had an apartment and this and that. So, well, it doesn't really pay. You know, like, we can give you, like, you know, for 4 weeks work, we can give you $100. I'm like, I can't, you know, do this, you know. So, but Leroy was there. And I'm like, and I went to him, Leroy, I'm really sorry. He's like, don't do it. he's like, you sound great, but just don't do it, you're gonna get screwed. It was the nicest thing anybody ever did. He said, just don't do it, it doesn't matter, I love you, you sound great. So I was a big fan of Leroy.
Is there any instrumentalists or that have had impact on the way you think about playing? Or I mean, you talk about being into the stuff based on things that's feel like they swing, whether it's Rollins or Carter.
Yeah.
You come in at stuff from that standpoint, as a, or any players that you like?
It's almost any instrument I love. I mean, obviously my father really shaped the way I hear melodies and the way you can play. I mean, there's certain performers that, you know, undeniably, you know, when you hear Glenn Gould play the Goldberg Variations, the last version he did, as opposed to the first version he did, and you just, oh God, if I could do that, you know, things like that, or, you know, Miles, and, you know, all the usual suspects that you'd think of. But I'll always think of this one time where we were rehearsing. I used to rehearse in the basement of my father's house in Framingham, you know, and he had this pianist, Rebecca LeBrec, who unfortunately died of a brain tumor, but she was one of the most amazing classical pianists, did all this modern work, and she played his piano concerto in Lincoln Center in the 80s. But she came down and was like listening to us, and she's sitting there, and we're playing. I had two keyboards for a quarter tone, and Randy was like, and I'm playing this like double neck electric violin, and we're doing all these notes. And she sits there and is like, yeah, you sound like you're playing your instruments. I'm like, what do you mean? And she sat down on the piano and just, it was an electric piano, not even a real piano. She's like, what if you make it sound like a banjo or this, you know, like a horn? Or why aren't you getting that out of, and she just made this digital piano sound like an orchestra, like just with a few notes. And I'm like, oh shit, I suck. But, you know, people that can really translate little things into grand ideas, I love.
You've been working for quite a long time now on your music, touring quite a bit around the world, recording for lots of different kinds of labels. ECM is a high profile label. You've done stuff with back in, you know, the early 2000s, and now you're doing some material with them, with this trio with Craig Taborn and Chess Smith. people have been around doing things, and this period of the last couple of decades, the music world, all through the music world, all kinds of music, has really gone under some radical changes. And I wonder, what's your perception in terms of your work? Has it affected it, aside from the economics of it, because that's always the challenge of doing something that's not commercial, but has it affected the way you go about doing the creative work? Like, how has touring changed, or has it changed for you? How do you perceive things, let's say, 20 years down the line from where you were?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. And I talk about this a lot because I never went to college, and I just finished college. I went to NEC for the past 2 years.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Before that, I was in Long Island University just for 2 years. So, and I talk about this a lot with students who are scared shitless, honestly. And I don't blame them. I mean, when I was coming up, it was like, Paul Blake, check him out. You know, there's nobody like, you can't do a Paul Blake anymore. You mm-hmm. can't. And then,
how do you mean that when you say that?
You know,
I think I know what you mean. But
you know, he came up in a generation, like he was like the last generation of like guys who could play freely and make a big mark and then still make some really money, you know, big money, and then go to hotels and say like, I need the suite or whatever. You
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah.
You know, like
the end of that generation.
That's kind of the last call of that kind of thing. And Paul Blair, I miss you, because he did a really nice thing for us. I don't know if you know this, but my father and I had been playing with a quartet and duets in Boston, and we had a nice large crowd, but that was it. We tried to hit New York or anywhere else. It was like, who are you? You know, like, so Paul Blair came and saw us. My father and I do a duet at Ryle's.
Oh yeah.
So we're playing this thing upstairs at Ryle's, and you know, there's about 40 people there, and whatever. We're doing this duet. Paul Blake walks in and checks us out. And the end of the gig, he goes like, "I'm doing this thing in Montreal. They're doing a big thing for me. Can you do a set with me?" Just like that.
Wow.
And just like that, international. Well, didn't happen overnight, but like suddenly it was like,
yeah, you opened the door for
it. It really. All of a sudden, we got a record on Leo, and then this, and then EC. You know, like it just.
Wow.
Without that, I don't know. You know, like sometimes you just need that one little minute of exposure.
Incredible.
So those kind of, like what I'm saying, to tie it back to your original question, those kind of minutes of exposure, I don't know if that would do it anymore the way it did back in 1991 or whatever that was. You know, you play in Montreal with Paul Blais, and suddenly, like, people are like, oh, you know. Not that that really happened. That was still many years before anything happened. But I do know that kind of set a ball in motion. But I do know that this music doesn't die.
Mm-hmm.
Creativity doesn't die. People frustrated with whatever, you know, we're seeing it in politics, we're seeing it in this and that, whether it's a little bit more underground or a little bit above ground, this is not going away. Financially, I wouldn't bet the ponies on it, you know. But if you're sincere and you work hard, this and that, it's not going to go away. We're going to meet each other in a place like this, or in a basement somewhere, or in a concert hall in Moscow. Who knows? You know, it's going to happen. But you don't know the scale of it, and it's going to be hard financially. Of course, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it was a violin. I didn't start on viola. Okay,
there we go.
So, my father wanted me to play an instrument. So I think at four, I took a few piano lessons and just got really tired of all these keys, and I couldn't deal with it. He's like, all right, you don't have to do that. We're going to go to the music store, and you pick out an instrument, anything you want, but you got to stick with it. So we go to the store and we're looking at horns and flutes and violins and this. And I'm looking at the violin and I'm 5 at this point. And I counted the strings. I'm like 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, how hard could this be? So I said, that's the one. And I regret it still to this day. But it's true, that actually happened.
Any other questions? Anything?
Yeah. I got a question about snake time.
Yes.
I don't know if snake time would apply to the kind of thing you just played, but I was surprised to hear you say that it's not rubato. I would think of...
Yeah, I mean... Well,
how is time meant to be felt in this sort of thing?
I don't know how time is meant.
How do you...
But it's not just kind of like... Ba-da-da-da-da. But there's a sense of like this... Just the way there's microtones, there's microtones that like, you know, like... You know, there's that kind of like shaving and shaving until maybe it's a different tempo. Now it's a little faster, but yeah. So these kind of things, while you're doing counterpoint and this and that, can really. So we call this snake time because it's like not quite defined. It's not like prog rock where like you know 19.7 against 14.8 and this and that, and then we shift to that. Because it's a little bit more fluid, but those things can kind of happen, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
But it really comes from that microtonal sensibility, instead of like, so it's that kind of tripping, kind of like, what is that? The note's a little off and the harmony becomes this, so the time becomes a little bit skewed. And this was more developed because of the way Randy Peterson played. A fantastic drummer who came out of the hard bop kind of thing. When I first met him, he was just like, and I'm playing, and how do we make this work? So it was a real, it wasn't kind of like, oh, I'm just going to start playing free. No, he took it so seriously that we sat for weeks in this basement, kind of like, well, you know, and suddenly we developed this kind of style and we called this snake time. But it's a very individual thing. I mean, there's no right answer to that, obviously.
Actually, can I ask a follow-up question?
For no. Yeah, of course.
Since you said it's a very individual thing, are there other musicians who or groups that you think of as doing, when you hear it, you're like, oh yeah, they got the same kind of snake time as I do?
Yeah, I've heard some guys do it. I mean, when I was like saying Sonny Rollins, I was just thinking of this one tune he did where like, you were my lucky star, or I can't remember the name of it. Mm-hmm. But and the way he plays this solo, and he's just tripping over the beat because he knows this form backwards. You could just tell, like, he's played that tune 5 million times in clubs and gin mills and this and that. And he's just like, and he's just always skewing it, that kind of thing. So like, that was a big inspiration. Yeah. There's a lot of people that do their own thing. Yeah.
What year was that you played at the Cultural Center? Do you remember?
It was 90.
No, I think it was...
Was it 2000?
It was in early 2000s, yeah, because Michael Orlov was part of that.
Right.
And he was still in town. So I think early 2000s, yeah.
Yeah, because I was at that show, and that blew my mind. Like,
yeah.
That's the first time I'd ever heard that type of
Yeah, and we were, like, stunned to see, like, all those people show. I was like, what the fuck's going on here? It was, like, suddenly, like, there's, like, more than 100 people. In this
It was a couple hundred people. A
couple hundred people, and, like... Yeah. You know, and it's like a free concert in this weird globe thing. There was like a line of people after the show going up to my father, like, just asking him. And I'm like, that gave me so much hope. Because, you know, a lot of times you do these things and you're playing and you get the three jazz critics that know everything with the white beards going, oh, it's the microtonal guy who does the thing from Boston. You know, like, and it's just that. And it's like, no matter what you play the most brilliant thing, and it's just like, right, it's the microtonal guy, you know. But this was just fresh people coming off the street and talking to us, and Randy was playing with us, the drummer, and his mother came because she lives in Milwaukee or something. It was just like, wow, Randy's mom. Things like that. But that was probably the most One of the my favorite memories of all time was that concert, actually.
That was a super special. Yeah. That was like one of those gigs where
it was just one of those things.
The acoustic, the way you guys dealt with that really crazy acoustic.
Right, we just dealt with it.
Yeah, you know, it was amazing. Yeah. Really amazing.
Thank you.